picture an acrobat standing on a tightrope. Now, the tightrope is our dimension, and our dimension has rules. You can move forwards or backwards. But what if, right next to our acrobat, there is a flea? Now, the flea can also travel back and forth, just like the acrobat, right?
Right.
Yeah. Here's where things get really interesting. The flea can also travel this way, along the side of the rope. He can even go underneath the rope.
Upside down.
Exactly.
Sheriff Hopper breaks into Hawkins' lab and discovers a portal they are hiding within. Security forces quickly subdue and drug him and leave him in his home, where they have installed listening devices to monitor him.
Will's funeral comes and goes, but doesn't give Joyce or Jonathan comfort, as they both independently realize there is much more to Will's disappearance than the official quarry cover story. Nancy and Jonathan vow to find Will and Barb or kill the creatures responsible for their disappearance.
The boys develop a working theory of Will disappearing through an interdimensional portal and attempt to use compasses to track the magnetic disturbance such a gateway would cause. Eleven, who is terrified of her encounters with the creatures that inhabit the shadowy other dimension, sabotages the boys' efforts. Lucas is furious with Eleven, which causes a rift in their friendship.
Nancy and Jonathan venture into the woods where Will disappeared and find a wounded deer that they see drug deeper into the forest. Nancy discovers a hollow tree that is infested with slime and, crawling through it, discovers the Demogorgon in its natural habitat as the portal slowly closes behind her. Welcome to Dungeons & Demogorgons, the officially unofficial podcast for Stranger Things on Netflix. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we just watched Season 1, Episode 5, titled Chapter 5, The Flea and the Acrobat, which, if you've seen the episode, you now understand the title.
Yeah, that's the best illustration Mr. Clark could come up with.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah?
Yeah, fleas can walk upside down on stuff.
I guess
he's essentially
true.
Like leaning into their upside down analogy that
but why
and doesn't
flea?
Know it.
Why a flea? Why not a housefly or a
spider
beetle?
Or a spider.
Yeah. Something, a spider would be really good because that would have some intrinsic danger to it, which I guess Mr. Clark, you know, he doesn't understand why the boys. He thinks they're just asking for some techno babble for their D&D campaign.
Yeah.
I did love that scene because Mr. Clark is like, he's like an OG Dungeons & Dragons guy.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, he was back at, you know, MIT or something on early versions of the internet, you know, trading around first edition Dungeons & Dragons stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome. I like the connections that these kids have to kind of the truth here, which, you know, Mr. whatever his name is, the science teacher, doesn't realize that he's giving them key information that they need to crack this case, but he is. And they have L and all their connections. I don't know. There's something about it that's more than the sum of its parts.
Yeah, I mean, it's like sometimes I wonder, like, should it bother me that, like, this is all just so? Like, the boys come and, like, oh, yeah, it's upside down. It's the Nether Realm. And he's like, oh, well, if it was this, then it would be this. And it would have this kind of enhanced gravity or magnetic signature. And you're like, compasses. And it would just – because, you know
– it's just believable enough, though.
It is believable enough. But on the other hand, I think a lot of people noticed their fucking compasses weren't working.
Yeah, pilots.
Pilots. Like, like back in the day, it wasn't uncommon to have, like, a compass mounted in your car or
– yeah.
You know,
before GPS.
Any Boy Scout troops, or I just feel like it would have been noticed. But, you know, it's a fiction show. What are you going
to
do?
Maybe it has been noticed, and they've all gone to the upside down and never came back.
Everyone asked questions. The lab, they're monitoring the phone lines. It was like, my compass gets around Mirkwood or whatever the hell its real name is, and it stops working. They just go and nab them. I mean, people are disappearing like flies. Yeah, they're disappearing like flies here in Hawkins.
Like fleas?
Hunters, like flying fleas. Their hunters are disappearing. I liked the scene where Hopper breaks into Hawkins' lab and he, like, combination ninja, bullshit artist, and pugilist gets in.
The old sneakeroo.
And then I think it tells something interesting about his character and how all in it is when he gets to this big, scary biohazard thing that's, like, all zipped up. He, like, briefly, like, I don't have a biohazard suit. Fuck it. Do I want to live forever drinking Jim Beam and smoking Pall Malls and staring off in the middle distance? Fuck no. And he just barrels right through it.
Yeah. But then the thing that really bothered me most about his actions there is leaving the door open. He doesn't seal it behind him. I feel like that's a real dick move.
The thing is like, is he going to be infected with something? Because those guys are real serious about doing the hazmat stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he went in there and he's coughing. It reminded me a lot of the spore parts of like The Last of Us where you got to have a breath mask or you're going to start sprouting things out of your eye holes and your ear holes, man. You're going to start clicking.
I mean, that's definitely a question that I think they want you to be asking, you know. Otherwise, they don't put this containment area in effect.
Yeah. And then when he's also, I think we joked, I don't know if it was off air or on air, but we joked about doing a super cut of all the Wills. Hopper would fill you know, 2 minutes of Will montage just with his performance. Like he was just screaming Will all the time at the lab here.
He was. Several people just shouting Nancy, shouting Jonathan. There's names all over the place. Yeah.
Yep.
I've got some other supercuts I have in mind.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. We'll maybe get to those.
Okay.
I'll maybe get around to actually cutting one together.
I also liked how they introduced as Lonnie getting back with Joyce or reconciling with Joyce plot, but didn't let it stretch over an episode. Mm-hmm. Because at no point did I buy that this guy's turned over a new. Like, I remember at the end of last episode, I'm like, well, I guess now that his son is dead, then, you know, even a piece of shit father would probably want to show up to a funeral and, you know, do whatever shitty fathers do, milk it for sympathy or, you know, use it as more fuel for their shame cycle or whatever. But I really like how he's trying to smoothly introduce the idea of, oh, this negligent Corey. And then she finds the thing in his pocket that says, like, you know, he's going to, like, sue. And that he's back there for the money.
Yeah.
And he wants to put Jonathan through school, but he can't name what school he wants to go to. I thought that was all pretty well done.
Yeah, they really jerked me around this episode with Lonnie because he comes in and he seems like a reasonable dude for the most part. You know, he's wrong. He's wrong about everything because, in fact, Joyce is not crazy. She actually did hear Will, and we know it, but, you know, he seems very reasonable in this situation, and I think they were doing that intentionally. They were setting me up for the fake-out where Lonnie is just a douchebag concerned with getting, like, I guess capitalizing on his son's loss. And I don't know. So if that's your primary motivation, that's certainly shitty.
Mm-hmm.
I think if that's, like, a secondary thing where he's concerned about, like, okay, not only have we lost our son, but we need to make these people pay. I could see that, but, you know, that seems to be his primary motivation.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I don't even think it's up for debate. And I mean, that would have been interesting to I guess, introduce an ally this late into the second act or beginning of the third act. But I'm kind of glad they didn't. I'm glad they're sticking to it that he's the shit. Is it?
I think it would undermine Jonathan.
If
he was calling his dad a douchebag and a shit and all these things, and Lonnie turns out to be a stand-up guy.
Right.
So, I mean, I talked about, you know, we don't know the situation between Nancy and Lonnie.
Mm-hmm.
Joyce and Lonnie.
Mm-hmm.
Get them confused. And I had, you know, speculated or theorized that maybe Lonnie, like maybe there was something between Joyce and Hopper, rather, that got, you know, a little too physical, and then Lonnie wasn't necessarily at fault here, but then he left his kids, and, you know, we were speculating, I guess, who was at fault. It seems like Lonnie is the douchebag here.
I mean, he's certainly
leaning back toward that.
A world-class manipulation artist where he, like, as soon as Joyce kind of cottons on to what he's trying to do, he just ramps up the emotional and verbal abuse, like telling her that she's a shitty mom because she let Will get killed or disappeared when he's not even been around. And, you know, it's pretty heinous. It's pretty heinous. So I'm all too happy to just dismiss this guy at this point. I really liked how they, you know, there's a lot of this, which I think is one of the charms of the show, where the boys map their knowledge of science fiction and fantasy onto this scientific process. And I like, you know, and it seems like Dustin is the one that makes those connections. Like, oh, it's like it's like the Veil of Shadows, and, you know, they intuit, and also Lucas is kind of the skeptic.
Sure.
Because that's this whole, he's like, you know, like Dustin says this, and him and Mike are like, oh, booyah, and Lucas is like, boo, nah, because he's not fully on board with all this, and that tracks through with him. You know, he's always been the one most skeptical of Eleven.
Yeah.
He's the one that sees through the, you know, subterfuge that she's trying to employ, mm-hmm. and it makes him, you know, very angry.
Yeah, and understandably so.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's Lucas's reaction here is not all practical. You know, a lot of this is coming from the emotion. I feel like in his head, L is stealing his best friend from him, Mike. Huh. And I feel like some of that is coming out in his anger, or that's a reaction to that.
I mean, for sure. I think it's interesting that you say that, though, because I think there's concrete reasons for him to be upset. Like,
absolutely, yeah.
You know, this is like Elle is being as manipulative as a Lonnie,
mm-hmm.
and then instead of just leveling with the guys and saying this is dangerous, I can't go along with it, or like she's trying to, yeah, I get it. She has no social graces, but she's trying to control and manipulate and her friend's behavior through manipulation.
Sure, yeah.
Like, instead of just telling them, I can't help you or whatever, she's actively trying to thwart it. And I get it. She knows a lot more about the situation, the danger, which we got a lot more of her backstory when, you know, her dad wants... It's becoming increasingly clear that what's happened here is that they were running some kind of CIA... MK Ultra program to do remote viewing of like Russian targets and intelligence targets, and yeah. L uses the what they're calling the upside down to kind of navigate across that space and time,
mm-hmm.
and they've made a connection. They've attracted attention of these other entities who now know about our world and are trying to get over there for reasons unknown.
Yeah,
and the way they told that, I thought. The visual of her in that inky black chamber cut like with ankle deep water was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Russian guy, like there's like a one shot where she's like centered in the room and she's very tiny. And it's just this like complete blackness with no like reflections of water. It's just very visually striking. It's also the other thing I wondered about is like, is that the upside down? Because if so, it looked very sterile and clean.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if the idea is that these are actually some from a dimension outside that, and they detect this activity, and they've kind of invaded in this bridge dimension that's eventually going to lead to Earth.
Hmm.
Because else why...
I suppose that's possible.
You know, why would the upside down Russia... mm-hmm. look like an empty swimming pool in outer space, and upside down Hawkins looks like it's been colonized by snot monsters.
Right. I don't know. There's something clearly growing throughout this season, right? Mm. Like the connections between our world and the upside down are growing.
Yeah, there's more than one portal now, we found out.
Right, yeah. There's that portal in the tree.
Which that must have been caused by the creature once it escaped the lab to get back into its...
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's what I kind of gathered anyway.
Yeah, it makes me wonder what's happening in the shed outside the buyer's house at the moment.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've been in there.
Yeah, maybe check on that. But yeah, there's definitely something is growing, and I don't know like if it spawned from the upside down or like you said came from even another dimension.
Yeah.
Into the upside down and is slowly corrupting that.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes you wonder if when you're watching this, like how much trouble is Sheriff Hopper in? If we've seen like them colonize his inert matter,
yeah,
and like these trees, like he's been inhaling these spores, like what you know? I'm looking for stuff shooting out of his orifices next episode. the other explanation for it being kind of like sterile is maybe that's because Elle didn't actually go into the upside down. She astrally projected herself into that dimension.
Yeah, we still don't know.
Because she was physically still in the tank. It wasn't like Nancy where she crawled through or like that soldier to push through the boundary.
Right.
So that's the other explanation. But I really did like the visuals of it.
Yeah. I'm also wondering if they're in this show are even other dimensions. You know, he talks about these parallel dimensions.
The mini worlds hypothesis.
Right. But the only one I think we ever see, and his analogy kind of betrays this too with the flea, right? the flea only ever has access, I think, to one of those dimensions. Well, I guess it can walk on the side or the bottom.
Yeah, or
in his analogy,
wasn't there also like a parallel cable that like the flea could jump to? Wasn't that part? Because I thought he drew two lines, and here is like, and he's like, yeah, he can go forward or backwards, or he can go under on the other side, or
I don't know.
Because that's the other thing is like, that's not a great illustration to then explain, like. That explanation, like, we took the pie plate, or not the pie plate, the paper plate, and he punched a hole through it. That's, like, the go-to explanation for how a wormhole works.
Yep.
But I didn't feel like it was a very good illustration for how the upside down works.
Yeah, he describes it as tearing a hole in space-time.
Because if you do that, like, you're going from one side of the upside, right side up, to another place on the right side up. It doesn't explain how you would get to the upside down.
Yeah.
And the show just hopes you don't notice any of that.
I mean, it's as close as he can come.
This D&D logic just maps one-to-one into the scientific world and, you know, just whistle right past that audience graveyard.
I'll blame him for his mustache, but I can't blame him for the poor translation of physics here to this fantasy.
Right. Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find the copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues, but then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question: who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV+, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Where do you think they were? They had this little segue scene or this flashback scene where Will and Joyce were, you know, he was, I guess, getting, they had stopped playing D&D and he's starting to play. Maybe this is like right after their dad left him and he's starting to get back in the D&D with his friends, and he's got Will the Wise coming out and he's drawing these fireballs, and he says that, you know, sometimes what did that scene mean? Was that just a little texture for their relationship, or are they trying to get somewhere with, you know, not being able to think yourself out of every situation, needing firepower?
Yeah, it's a good question.
I mean, it's great just as a character building scene, but it felt like maybe something more.
Yeah, it felt a little disconnected from this particular episode. I'm hoping that that's building to something bigger that we'll understand in the next three episodes. But I think, I don't know. I mean, we've asked the question, you know, how has Will managed to survive so long in the Upside Down?
Right.
When the Demogorgon is stalking him. Well, I mean, he's the Wise, right? He might be smart, but maybe the Demogorgon is smarter. Mm. And maybe they're trying to convey that the Demogorgon is also very intelligent.
That's a good point.
And that he can't defeat the Demogorgon. Best right. he can do is run from it, but maybe they need a weapon that can. Like, oh, I don't know, L. Yeah. L seems pretty powerful, but who knows? I mean, she ran from the Demogorgon as well.
Right.
When she was talking to the Russian guy. So I don't know what the extent of her powers are in that world. And I don't know if she could defeat it.
Why do you think Jonathan is adamant about keeping... He's got this conversation with Nancy where she's like, well, maybe you should tell your mom that she's not crazy. And he's like, no, I'll tell her after the monster's dead. Why doesn't he just tell his mom? Like, they left at a pretty bad place.
Yeah.
Where he says that, I guess I'll just take everything on my shoulders and plan my little brother's funeral and blah, blah, blah. And now, since they've last talked, I guess it's Lonnie, isn't it? That's the thing. Because he went back and tried to have that conversation with his mom, and Lonnie interfered with it.
Yeah.
So he thinks that she has, in a moment of weakness, gone back to this person, and he sees through all the bullshit.
Right.
He's not sure what the scam is, but he knows there's a scam. I guess that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's a damn shame, though.
Yeah. I do like this this idea that, you know, we've seen the Upside Down interfering with, like, electronic devices and stuff. I don't think we ever really understood that it could interfere with the magnetic field, and that the compasses might be the very thing that points them in that direction. I know we talked about this briefly, but I thought that was a nice touch, that they would have some physical way to track this thing down.
And something that kids...
That's accessible to a kid.
Would readily have, because I had tons of compasses when I was a kid.
Right, they come out of Cracker Jack boxes
they
every other day.
They certainly do. So, like, you're right. It's I don't begrudge them that explanation, because it was a nice gateway to, yes, this is still a child-scale problem.
Yeah.
Like, once they find a Demogorgon, what are they going to do? But for right now, they are able to, as a band of children, believably execute this quest of theirs.
Right. I like that you put it that way, because it's most certainly not a child scale problem, but they're portraying it as one, right?
And right.
And it feels right. It doesn't feel like these kids are way out of their depth.
Right. And they're not being whiny, stupid kids. They're like pretty smartly and soberly dealing with these problems and figuring out what's going on and having, like, it's funny because a lot of shows like this rely on the characters not talking and mm-hmm. like not telling their true feelings, and this show like the characters pretty much play everything, all their cards face up on the table, because they're a group of friends that love and trust each other.
Yeah.
And guess you can still generate conflict within a group with everyone talking about their true intentions all the time.
Yeah. Except where the natural divides are, you know, between parents and children. Like,
Elle's
those
not,
things.
Elle's the outsider group, and she's not sharing, but that makes sense, right?
Right.
It wouldn't make sense for Lucas to, you know, go along with stuff without misgivings or...
Mm-hmm. And I like when they do, you know, when they kind of talk about the Upside Down and they connect it to the Veil of Shadows and they're talking about this portal, and Hopper is actually at that portal.
Yes.
I like how they're connecting like this theoretical thing that the kids are talking about and this very real thing that Hopper is going to.
Yeah, the like Dustin's voiceover is describing the veil of shadows as he's walking through this place was a very nice touch. I thought Hopper was like increasingly deranged in this episode, like when he wakes up, because it's like obviously the Hawkins Laboratory folks want him to wake up and think, oh, it's all been a dream.
Yeah, stupid.
And like literally is like, fuck that from second one of regaining consciousness. He tears a powder, finds the bug. His deputies come to tell him that it turns out Barb just ran away. The Stadies found her car at the train station, which is the most menacing thing they could probably tell him with a straight face. And he's like, oh, that's fucking crazy.
Yeah.
It's weird because I'm wondering, like, I don't feel like Sheriff Hopper is going to make it out of this season unscathed.
Hmm.
Like, it feels like this, if there's a resolution, I'm wondering if the resolution is not going to be, he is going to be completely out of a job, because they're showing his like, this is a one-man quest of his versus shadowy forces in the federal government that are all high-level national security and intelligence-type people, and his own men think that he's acting nutty, and they're like, he's spending too much time with that crazy Joyce.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like it's going to end well for him.
I mean, what possible outcome, you're right, does this have for Hopper with the powers that be? You know, like, I don't mean the nefarious ones. I mean the authority of the police and whatnot. Like, him going off and doing this crazy thing. Let's say, I mean, I guess short of bringing Will back or taking a camera in and like documenting this upside down thing, I don't know how he explains to anyone the quest he's been on.
Yeah. Good luck. I mean, that's the other theme, is like all these people that are like on in the know, or that are quote unquote woke, their constant theme is, what do we got to do? We have no one to trust but ourselves, because no one will believe us.
Yeah.
And we'll make ourselves a target if we start talking about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was pretty cool. What did you think about the conversation that Hopper has with his ex-wife? Like, why?
Yeah.
You know, they still haven't come right out. I mean, I guess they have. Like, that they had a daughter that died.
Yeah.
And that, like, it happens many times, broke their relationship. But he clearly loves her. She's clearly moved on. He has clearly not been able to move on. He calls her because...
Which... It kind of makes me think that maybe the problem was more on his end. Maybe he couldn't let it go. Maybe it was very much like a Will thing, and he went down some sort of rabbit hole on his own. Because she's got another kid, right? Like, she's married to this Bill guy. She's got another kid. She seems to have moved on with her life.
But that could be like she just got tired of showing up to see the guy's face that's the father of the child that's dead now. Like, it's a constant reminder. It's like...
Well, I'm kind of going on assuming a parallel between his ex and Joyce in this case. Like, the show is trying to say that this is how someone in this situation reacts.
Uh-huh.
And I know it's not going to be the same for everyone, but in terms of the show.
Right.
You know, Joyce yells, look, I'm going to leave these lights up until the day I fucking die if I think Will is out there.
Yeah.
I don't see that behavior, I guess, from his ex. But I very much thought he called her because he thought he was on a suicide mission. And this was just the finality of their relationship.
Is he on a suicide mission?
I feel like he thought he was. I don't know.
Because he went over to Joyce's house.
Yeah, but I think this is just a precursor to something bigger.
Huh. Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, he's not going to let it drop, right? He knows that there's some crazy thing happening at this lab.
Right.
And he's got to pursue it.
He wants to know. He wants his ex-wife to know when the federal goons call.
Yeah.
That he has been drinking and acting erratically, and I don't know. It's a weird, because also, like, that's... kind of putting a target on her back.
Yeah.
You know, like, calling if they her. Go through and call and he has this crazy conversation with them, like, obviously the Hawkins lab people are listening to that, so...
I think it's maybe why he tries to cover with, yeah, I've been drinking.
Oh, so he just gives the excuse of...
Yeah, he's trying to... I think he was there for a purpose, which was to just say goodbye, essentially, because he thinks the goons are coming for him. Mm-hmm. And then somewhere through that call, he realizes this was not worth it and changes his mind.
I like the Nancy and Jonathan stuff. This is very, you know, we talk about Stephen King being a big influence on this work, and this instance of like two kids talking about their life and seeing this through the prism of the supernatural thing that's happening to them, I thought was good. Like, you know, Nancy opening up to Jonathan about like her mom making the choice to, you know, essentially date and marry this older man who represented stability, but also kind of like boredom. Mm-hmm. And a settling for some kind of status quo and comfort. And, you know, last episode, I was really restless with their relationship as it was, because I felt like they didn't really address Jonathan being a creep.
Yeah.
And what's weird is in this episode, they addressed it more, and I'm like, aha, they're going to finally have it out. But they use this information that Nancy herself gave Jonathan the scene before for Jonathan to essentially emotionally dunk on her.
Yeah. No, he scores big time there.
Like, well, brutal. You've got no real explanation for this creepy thing. In fact, the explanation you're giving is kind of even more creepy and entitled to my, you know, like he's making all these sweeping judgments about her and her trying to be someone she's not and all this other bullshit.
Yeah.
And he comes back with like, well, you just want to marry some stupid jock so you can make the same mistake your mom is like, well, this is her first boyfriend, jackass. Right. Everyone fucks. Like, but I think 99% of people fuck up that way the first time. Like, if you're lucky, yeah, you get out of that, like, that relational pattern. But
yeah, for sure. But I think that's where he hits home, is her mom didn't, right? Her mom didn't realize that that's what she was doing.
Yeah.
And ended up where she is, I guess, in a... Her dad is
it does feel like he's getting let off the hook, though, a little bit, you know?
Yeah. I mean, certainly Jonathan, I don't know what it would take at this point for me to feel like she believed Jonathan was not a creep.
Saving her life, like...
Maybe. Yeah, if he can go after her into the Upside Down, maybe.
Or him just saying, like, I get it. I mean, that's the thing. He kind of apologizes,
not being so defensive.
But it doesn't feel like it's hard. He's like, I'm upset that you're upset.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
that like I realize what a kind of betrayal and invasive thing I did, and I would never do something like that again. And I objectified you literally in the truest sense of the word. Like, there's none of this realization. I don't. And it's like, I feel like they're also trying to, although they reintroduce Steve. Mm-hmm. I feel like they're trying to make me feel like that maybe Nancy and Jonathan could possibly couple up, and I'm not having it until they fix this this deal with Jonathan being defensive and in denial about his fucking photography bullshit.
Yeah, maybe he needs to take how would you photographically make it okay? Would he let her take pictures of him through a window?
Yeah.
Is that what's gonna happen?
Yeah. And then hand them out at school,
right?
Or he needs to, I don't know, he needs an American Beauty to take a sad photo
of
a video
garbage
of
bag.
A garbage bag floating through the air. Except for, I don't think they invented plastic bags back in the 80s. They're
no?
still like, oh, this all
still
all
paper?
Brown, yeah, brown bag in it back then.
Oh shit, I wasn't buying groceries in the 80s.
What do you think of Sheriff Hopper showing up with the "Don't Say Anything" sign and then beginning a disturbing and inappropriate shot-for-shot remake of Love Actually?
I just love the look
on his
face.
Why Lonnie's back there? Who's at the doors? Right. Who's at the door, Joyce?
Yeah, I just love the look on his face when he sees all the lights in her house, and he goes, "Oh shit, this is gonna take forever."
You know how long it's gonna take me to unscrew all these fucking light bulbs, Joyce?
Yeah.
Oh my god. Although on the other hand, you already have holes in your walls, so that's one less step I got to take.
I don't understand why he doesn't just pull her outside and go into the woods and talk.
Yeah.
Like, do you have to talk inside?
That's true. Try to bug the woods. It's all whistling wind and crunchy leaves.
And Demogorgons.
And
like,
Demogorgons.
Not going to get anything over the gurgling of the Demogorgon.
I was really... The other thing that this episode surprised me in was how violent Eleven was with Lucas.
Yeah.
Like when Lucas and Mike were fighting, she just fucking hurls him like 30 feet with her mind and knocks him unconscious.
Yeah.
He's got a pre-adolescent concussion to deal with on top of all the other stuff he's going through in life. I thought that was that it number one shows us her powers, but also kind of lets us know that, you know, Elle's kind of a scary thing.
Yeah, for sure. And that she maybe doesn't quite know how to control herself.
And it narratively also kind of pumps the brakes, because I feel like if these four would unite and be on one same page, like, mm-hmm. you know, the Demogorgon is probably going to be fucked. Unless it's the type of story that he's just going to, you know, these kids are all going to disappear and be killed. Doesn't feel like it's that story. Like, yeah. I just watched It, and it feels like the whole time in It, all the kids are going to die, and they don't. So... Hmm. I feel like Stephen King. He likes to feel like there's a lot of danger, but actually putting people in danger, especially kids, not so much.
Yeah.
The other thing I guess I'm not sure about is they find this dead deer. Nancy and John are at nighttime. Jonathan is holding the gun, even though he's the worst shot.
Yeah.
It doesn't help that apparently that pistol has no rear sights, but Nancy's a talented instinctual shooter, and mm-hmm. she should be holding the gun.
She should.
But then again, she would probably leave it on the other side of the portal, like she did her backpack and her fucking only other defensive weapon, so maybe he should hold it.
Yeah, but she's in big trouble at the end of this episode.
But the deer, like, it doesn't make sense that the deer was, like, lightly wounded by the Demogorgon, and then they show up and they're deciding what to do about it, and then it just, I guess, the Demogorgon psychically pulls it into the woods. I'm trying to think from the Demogorgon's point of view, like how this all goes down. Like the Demogorgon's like, I mortally wounded the deer. Let me wander off a couple, you know, somewhere into the forest to like check things out in the opposite direction from these teens tromping through the woods, and now I'm going to psychically pull the deer to me into the port. Like, what?
You know, now that you say that, I assumed that the Demogorgon had attacked the deer to begin with, but is it possible that it was actually hit by a car
and had wandered into the woods? It looked like it had fang marks all over it.
Yeah.
That's what it looked like to me, but
I don't know. I didn't get a great
look
at it.
So the Demogorgon's more of an opportunistic scavenger than it is a true killer. It's fundamentally yeah. less. It's more of a hyena than a lion.
Demogorgon's just misunderstood. If he just had somebody to talk to here in the real world.
Yeah, he's like an ethical vampire. He refuses to kill, but if there's, you know, a deer hit by a car, sure. He'll put it out of its misery and eat it.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm probably not as brave or foolish, maybe a little bit of both, as Nancy in this particular situation, because she calls for Jonathan. Honestly, I'm giving Jonathan more than 10 seconds because...
Before I crawl through the creepy-ass slime tree?
Right.
Looks like...
And that's the thing. I don't know if I climbed through the slime tree at all.
No, I have a very firm... If something looks like the tree where Christopher Walken was storing heads in Sleepy Hollow, don't crawl through that tree. I don't care if it's slime mold. I don't care if it's Silly String. I don't care if it's He-Man Hordak slime.
Which bald move rule is that?
17, why not?
17? Okay.
I don't crawl through that tree, man.
Yeah, I'm with you.
It kind of made me gag as Nancy's crawling through and that shit's getting all in her hair. And
yeah.
I mean, yeah, she's definitely brave, but yeah, also maybe wait a minute. And
yeah, wait for Jonathan. You call his name and immediately go into the tree?
Yeah. The other thing I'm worried about is how are they going to keep the suspense if these Demogorgons keep being, like, toothless? Like, if Nancy crawls through there, no weapons and a flashlight,
yeah,
and no real street smarts or anything, and manages to elude it even though the portal shuts behind her, then are the Demogorgons even a threat? If an 11-year-old boy and a 17-year-old girl can give it the business on its home turf, like, what the fuck was with Barb?
Yeah, I don't know. It caught her off guard.
Like, if Barb wasn't stuck in the bottom of that pool, I feel like she gets away and there's three people playing Ring Around the Rosie with the Demogorgon.
Yeah, probably.
But they gotta have some way to, like, have Nancy recover from that. Like if maybe Will, if Jonathan finds her and shoots the Demogorgon or something, because, like, otherwise... They're really in danger of making the Demogorgon look out to be some kind of paper tiger.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The portal closes behind her, so I don't even... Jonathan doesn't even know where she is.
No. No one will.
And he's not going to know that there was a portal there.
The nearest portal's in Hawkins' lab, or yeah. maybe over in by Will's house.
Shed, yeah.
But either way, how is she going to find it, and how is she going to elude the Demogorgon? Looks like her flashlight's not working properly in that.
Yeah.
Plus, she drops it anyway when the Demogorgon screams at her. The Demogorgons can't see. That's an established fact, right?
Because
she's playing, she's shining the flashlight all over it. It makes no notice until she breaks the twig.
Yep,
it's literally like a clicker from The Last of Us.
Okay,
because it doesn't
face is
doesn't
a mouth.
Have eyes, but that doesn't really mean anything. It could have, I don't know, light sensing devices spread evenly across its skin. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Life finds a way. what else do we want? Is there anything else we need to talk about?
That's all I've got.
Okay. Well, we'll see how they get Nancy out of this jam without defanging the multiple fanged Demogorgon on the next episode. Thanks for listening to our Season 1 coverage of Stranger Things. If you like what you hear and want more, check out all of our television, movie, and pop culture content on baldmove.com. If you'd like to help support our podcast and get a ton of bonus content and features, check out club.baldmove.com. We'll also be taking feedback during our upcoming Season 1 wrap-up podcast, so send that in to strangerthings@baldmove.com. You can also discuss this with your fellow fans at forums.baldmove.com or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.